Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And Craig, in his latest Florida Phoenix column, introduces us to another Florida villain.
Well, it's a guy I've been writing about off and on for about 10 years. His name's Carlos Baruff, and he's a big-time developer in the Sarasota Manatee County area. Medallion Homes is his main company, and he has been chafing at the wetlands protection regulations in Manatee County for years. He actually sued the county twice to try and overturn them and lost both times. And his expert witness for those cases was this guy named Dan DeLisi from West Palm Beach, who's a land use guy. He's not a wetlands biologist or by any means. So there's now a majority on the county commission that's very, I want to say, anti-wetlands, pro-business, and they wanted to completely rewrite the wetlands regulations that had been successfully defended in court. And so they hired Dan DeLisi to be their expert, to tell them what they could do. And DeLisi says, well, you can just get rid of them and depend on the state. And so that's, by a vote of 6-1, that's what they did, even though they had a room full of people saying, don't do this.
Yeah,
don't do it.
I'd like to tell Dan DeLisi what he can do. but this is an interesting topic, because we're seeing this all over the state, and in the name of private property rights, hey, I own this, I should be able to do whatever I want with it, whether that's a phosphate mine or a shuttle pad to private space exploration, or put a Flash Foods there, and these wetlands,
or a pigsty for that matter.
Yeah, you wrote about that recently. And the wetland protections were essentially, you can't build within 50 feet, or there was a 50-foot buffer around wetland areas that the county designated. We're saying this is defined as a wetland. It meets all the criteria. And then if you wanted to develop on one of those areas, you had to have, I forget what your exact language was, but there had to be a damn good reason, essentially.
A public purpose. It had to be beneficial to the public, because wetlands are beneficial to the public just by existing. They protect us from flooding. They recharge the aquifer. They provide valuable habitat.
Filter the water. I mean, do any number of civic duties, essentially. But the commission there in Manatee County, by a 6-1 vote, I mean, this was not like a razor's margin. It was overwhelmingly said, out of hell with it. We'd rather have gas stations, convenience stores, and more, residential development than wetlands. And the one of that 6-1 vote was surprised by this, reading the column.
Yeah, he thought it was a slam dunk, 7-0 reject the idea, which the Planning Commission, they had been 4-2 against changing the wetlands rules. And instead, the commission votes 6-1. And I should mention, the one, like several members of the commission, Republican, real estate guy, but says, I understand the importance of wetlands. I understand the need to keep them in place. I don't understand why my colleagues don't understand that.
FloridaPhoenix.com. And it is also hurricane season, and those wetlands do a great job of soaking up all of the excess water and rain we're going to get from hurricane season, the storm surge. Pavement doesn't soak up storm surge.
No.
Everyone wonders why we're having so much more flooding. And this is not just in Florida, but the flooding in Vermont, the flooding in Chicago. You see these big stories. We've got forest fires and flooding. Well, the flooding has as much to do with more rain as it does with impervious surface, concrete, roofs, asphalt, roads, pavement, parking lots. Anyways, going off on a tangent here. Windstormproducts.com. It's hurricane season. They will help protect your home from hurricane wind damage. Visit windstormproducts.com. Also want to thank all of our patrons at patreon.com/welcometoflorida. For as little as $5 a month, you can help support the show by becoming a patron, and you will receive regular bonus content. Craig, we're due for another bonus episode here probably in September, exclusively to our patrons at patreon.com/welcometoflorida. The column this week leads nicely into our conversation, because when you have fewer wetlands, when you have more development, when you have more light, you have fewer fireflies.
Yes. I think for a lot of people, seeing fireflies is a sort of magical experience from their childhood. And it seems like these days, the one firefly kids are familiar with is the one from The Princess and the Frog, Raymond. You know, so they're familiar with this cartoon firefly, but they're not seeing real fireflies the way maybe you and I did when we were kids. So I thought, let's talk to an expert on that.
Mark Branham is a professor at the University of Florida in the Department of Entomology, Insects, and Nematology. He's been at UF for 20 years. He's a leading researcher in the field of fireflies, and he joins us today on Welcome to Florida.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. As I was reading up a little bit about fireflies, I ran across something that I did not know, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, Florida has more firefly species than any other state. Is that right?
That is correct. And so like Florida has like approximately 59 species that are like found inside of the state border, right? And like that is the highest number of a firefly species within the US. But it's really interesting when I talk about fireflies here in Florida, especially, and I'm talking with some people that are from Florida. They like almost always say, man, I just don't see all that many. And or they say, I didn't know that we had any fireflies here. Wow. And I think that is because lots of people really don't spend a lot of time outside at night in these areas where it's like super dark. I think a lot of people hang out near their porch lights or on like a soccer fields that are all like really, really highly illuminated. And then of course, fireflies find that very, very difficult. Those species that are like actually flashing these like super cool bioluminescent signals, having a lot of light in these environments are like far from ideal.
They use the lights for mating. Is that correct? Is that what that's for?
Yes. And so not all fireflies actually can produce light as an adult, but there's a lot of species which like certainly can, obviously, and they use those signals as a courtship signal. It's a way males and females can find each other in these environments. And then also each species has its own unique flash pattern. So they like have their own timing parameters. You know, some of these species only flash once or twice, and it's a very slow rate of flashing. Others, it's a lot faster. And then like some of them fly in these like aerial acrobatic patterns while they're lit up. And so like if you know your firefly dialects, right, you can like literally drive down the road on like a dark summer night and count how many species might be on the side of the road. And for a long time, fireflies have been like talked about as an example of you know, romantic courtship, where there's a male flying along and he's flashing and he's essentially advertising, here I am, I am a member of this one species, right? And so the females, very commonly within the U.S., sit on the like underlying vegetation and, you know, like maybe down in the grass, and they'll wait until they see a male of their own species, which they find attractive. And it's dark, right? And so the like, only thing they can assess about that male is his flash pattern. And it's really interesting if you like sit outside on like a dark, warm summer night with your favorite beverage, and you just like watch this occurring. Fireflies, female fireflies are not noticeable until they start flashing, and they only flash back at a male which they find attractive. And like what is not a big surprise, I think, is that like a female's tend to be very selective in like to like which males they will flash back to. And then the male then like hopefully sees that, he'll flash back to her and she'll flash back to him, and they like have this have this short flash dialogue until the male figures out exactly where she is on her perch. However, there are some other males flying around of the same species generally, which like don't have quite an attractive signal themselves. And so these are called satellite males, in that they will try to like race the males that are like a super attractive to the females as an imposter, and then try to mate with that female.
This sounds very complicated. More than you know, knock three times on the ceiling if you want me. Complicated.
Right, exactly. And then like furthermore, what is like super interesting is that like if you like spend a lot of time outside at night, especially here in Florida, there's a lot of bats flying around, right?
And yes.
And you like, I've never seen a bat take a firefly, even though they are like both really active in the same environment. And these like fireflies light up and they're like super obvious. And then the bats are like zipping around. And so some of my colleagues and I wondered about this, and we thought, well, so like, why don't we see bats take these fireflies? And like, might a firefly flash pattern also be a warning signal? And so we like actually raise bats in a captivity, and we like showed them fireflies in the simulated flight room, and we had like firefly decoys, and we had fireflies that could flash, but they were like actually not flashing in our experiments, because we had like painted over their light organ, and we did like lots of like different things. But to make a long, complicated story short, just about every North American firefly species that like has been examined, with some exceptions, of course, are actually chemically defended. And so these are insects which do not taste well. Ah. They don't taste good at all. And like
broccoli for bats.
Exactly. I mean, like very, very similar, right? I mean, yeah. And like I've got video of us like holding a bat, and we like have a firefly in these in a pair of forceps, and we're like holding it up right up in front of the bat, and it's like feeding broccoli to a child.
Yeah.
Did not want to bite that thing. And was just not interested.
Not gonna eat it. Nope.
Whatsoever. And so, like, essentially, firefly flash patterns really are not produced for our entertainment. These are things that like a function as a courtship signal, obviously, but they also serve as this warning signal to the potential predators in these habitats. And at night, what a better way to like advertise how bad you taste with a light, because yeah. it's
the
so
opposite
obvious.
Of eat at Joe's. It's don't eat here.
Don't eat Joe. Yeah. How do they make the light?
And so like fireflies actually have two chemicals which they make in their body. And the first is called luciferin, and then the second is called luciferase. And their luciferase is the like enzyme that like actually drives this whole chemical reaction. And like fireflies, which are beetles,
they're beetles?
They are beetles. So like
they're not flies, they're beetles.
They okay. are called fireflies, but they're like actually beetles. And so like in that way, they are like it's like a thing like you know, dragonflies. Dragonflies are not officially flies, but they're called, you know, I don't know that these things fly. So I don't know. Common names sometimes can be fairly.
My grandmother used to call them mosquito hawks. So
yeah. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense here in Florida.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so fireflies are insects, and insects don't actually breathe through their head, through their face, but they have holes all the way down their body that like they can like open and they can close, and that's how they breathe. And so they would like move like oxygen into their body through a little bitty portholes all the way down their body. Hmm. And like a fireflies basically combine when they want to light up, they will combine these two chemicals, which they like generate, and they are luciferin and also luciferase with oxygen, which they like move into the light into the light organs, and they combine that with some other chemicals such as like ATP and some magnesium. And we have found that like it's the oxygen which like actually drives this chemical reaction. And so like when a firefly wants to like turn on, it will essentially let in oxygen into their light organ, and then it turns on. And then when they want to shut it off, then they restrict oxygen flow into their light organ, and they will shut off. Incidentally, firefly light organs are a lot like light bulbs. Some of these species have a reflective layer in the like back of their light organ, which is like made out of urea crystals. And so like these are like essentially urine crystals that are like incorporated into their light organ. And it like serves as a reflective layer, like you find in your car headlights. And it helps to like push all of the photons out of the front of the light organ. And so I think that's pretty cool in that like a firefly's invented that first. And then like we then incorporated that.
We're just a bunch of copycats. We really are. Yeah.
This is an unusual area to devote your life's work to. How did you get interested in fireflies to pursue it to this extent?
I always collected insects as a kid, and I also liked to be outside. And like I in short attribute pretty much all of this to the fact that like we had a like very small, very crappy black and white TV. And so like I didn't watch TV a lot. I was outside playing, and I was fishing, and I was hiking around. And so I just like always liked outdoor things, and I enjoyed nature. And then in college, I was really intrigued by like animal communication, and I liked beetles. And so I thought, hey, here's a way I could combine the two, and I could like study signal evolution in this organism that is super interesting. It's like found all around the world, and it is bioluminescence, living light. It's this unique kind of a signal system of a communication system that's a lot easier to work on than say like bioluminescent fish, which you like oftentimes have to like get into a submarine and like spend a lot of time descending into the abyssal depths, and then you're like looking out of a small porthole. And you
that's no fun.
Yeah. So
fireflies are much more fun. where for the people who've never seen them, where would you tell them to go to find fireflies, to see them for the first time?
So fireflies in like a Florida are like most commonly found where it is like fairly dark at night. And so like places away from like bright lights that are like a human generated, because fireflies have to like employ bioluminescent flash patterns to like find their mates. And so they will be most active and then also most visible where it's darker. And they're also predators in their like immature stage. And so like a firefly larvae feed on slugs and on snails and on earthworms. And so like in the environments where you find a lot of those prey items, you will also find a lot of fireflies. And so in the parts of the country, as in like a Florida and the rest of the Southeast, it's the areas that like are the most moist, have a lot of moisture, have a lot of organic matter on top of the soil, and are also far away from like a bright lights. Now, like up in the like Midwest, I would say fireflies are the most commonly encountered right at dusk, and over open athletic fields and things like that. But like that's primarily one species, Photinus pyralis, which is not found in Florida, but it is found a lot farther north.
Should you look around at where there's a body of water? Because that's what I'd always heard was that's where you find them.
Yes, yes, yes. And so like a fireflies here in Florida, really, we have quite a few species that are like a snail predators. And so like these guys like to find snails, and you'll find fireflies over the salt marshes on the like Gulf Coast. And these firefly larvae actually will like crawl down into the water and like capture a snail. And these firefly larvae also are so cool in that they all have hollow mandibles, sort of like rattlesnake fangs.
Wow.
And they will like bite their prey with these hollow mandibles, and they like inject several different chemicals, which will like paralyze first and then like liquefy their prey. It's almost like a science fiction movie. And and they will like then feed on their prey. Now, like, of course, if you were to like handle them, they aren't dangerous and they're not harmful to us. But like, as far as we know, fireflies in the adult stage are like generally not predators. And I say like generally not, because there are like some species in this one genus Photurus, which are not chemically defended. They can't make their own defensive chemicals, but they actually steal those from some other firefly species. And it's really interesting in that like it's the females of these species who will like mimic the flash pattern of the other species found in the same area. And those males come in thinking that they're going to find a female of their own species and then mate, but they arrive and it's not the right female, and they get captured and killed and then consumed. And it's not just for their protein, it is for their defensive chemicals. Wow. And then
ladies night takes a dark turn here.
right and these are females are called femme fatales, as you would expect, right?
Yeah.
And then the female will save those defensive chemicals, and they discard the shriveled husk of the male after like he is consumed. Uh-huh. And they then move those chemicals to their eggs, which are like then incorporated into their eggs and then their larvae up to a certain extent. And then these fireflies, as they become adults, have to acquire additional compounds. And so wow. you have the situation out there where there are these fireflies and they're like flying around just trying to find a mate. And they're also advertising, you know, hey, I don't taste good. Yet you have other things trying to eat them, other fireflies, for their defensive compounds. I mean, it's like a regular summer night, right? It is complicated out there.
How are firefly larvae? Because I'm thinking fireflies are like the size of your fingernail or something. How are they able to eat snails, which I imagine is much larger?
Yeah. Well, they will nip them with these like mandibles, and they then like inject these substances into their prey, and it like essentially paralyzes them. And so the snail cannot like fully retract into its shell, and they just sort of relax like they're intoxicated. And then the firefly larvae basically like feed on those snails. In some parts of Asia, there are some fully aquatic firefly larvae that have gills, and they will hunt the snails, which are also fully aquatic underwater, and they will eat the snail and then like live in that snail shell, just like a hermit crab does. And they'll like haul it around until they get too big for that shell. And then they'll like trade up into a bigger shell.
What's amazing. The most common firefly species in Florida?
Oh gosh. That's hard to say. And I just say that because, Florida is a state obviously that, has a lot of different habitats. And so like Northern Florida is like pretty drastically different, than like than is Southern Florida. And so like Northern Florida is a lot more temperate, than of course, South Florida. And so up in the more temperate regions of our country, we find fewer firefly species, but like we find more fireflies per each species. And so like up in like Iowa, Kansas, Ohio, you can like literally see massive fields full of like millions of fireflies, and they're all just one species and they're all flashing. Here in Florida though, most places it's a lot more subtropical. And so like we have many more species, but we have many fewer individuals within one habitat for each species. And so like a fireflies in a cypress dome, as an example, you like might find maybe 100, maybe a couple hundred in a big cypress dome. But like up in like central Iowa over a soccer field, it could be like millions of a single species. And then like also here in Florida, we have a single species which is like found over salt marsh, and that is the only thing found over a salt marshes that are like a flashing, and you don't see a lot of individuals. So like what is the most common species? It like really depends upon where you are, and then like also what time of night that you're like actually in that environment. And so fireflies sort of like treat a single evening as like an axe of a play. And so you might have one or two species come out right at dusk, right? And they'll start flashing, and then like they will stop flashing probably like a half an hour after dusk as you have a one or two more species come out, and then like so they'll start flashing. And you also have some that like flash very low to the ground. Others flash only like a high up in trees. And so they will try to partition up the evening into like certain blocks of time, and then also partition up the habitat into like a different areas where they actually flash. So I don't
shift
know.
Change. It's a shift change.
right. Yeah. That's absolutely right.
How are the population figures broadly across the state compared to historic levels? You know, have they seen a collapse, like bird species, mammal species, other insect species, frogs, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And so, yes, we are seeing much fewer fireflies these days, even in these areas that we like had been studying in the past. We are finding many, many fewer fireflies now. There could be several different things affecting them in that way. So fireflies, as we know, need to have some moisture in these habitats. And so like some of these areas have been drying out, maybe like as the like local like aquifers have been dropping. It could also be based upon like increased development in those areas, and you know, like and also habitat destruction and like more light in these areas too. But I suspect it is probably like all those things wrapped together.
Yeah.
Pesticides, is that a problem?
It certainly could be. We have like a just got a grant to actually quantify that and to like see if the insecticide use might be affecting fireflies. Certainly, there are like lots of mosquitoes all across Florida, and they can be a serious problem. And so mosquito spraying pretty much occurs when you have some of these species active. But you know, like, as of right now, there is not any good data that is suggestive spraying actually hurts fireflies. And that's something, though, that we like want to like explicitly look at.
Aside from, you know, I think that people ask me, oh, you know, what can I do to help the environment conservation? I think the easiest thing, and it relates to fireflies, is turn your lights off at night. You know, you can change your investment portfolio. You can do all kinds of volunteer work. You can write your congressman. You can go to county commission meetings. The easiest meaningful thing I think someone can do to help slow the extinction crisis is turn your lights off at night, because so many moth species, the fireflies, obviously, so many insects are active at night. When they're banging into your porch light, they're not out there doing what they need to be doing. Aside from turning lights off at night, what else can, you know, Joe citizen do to help these species just in their own backyard if they happen to exist there?
Or front yard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a super question. And I think like a certainly turning off outside lights is, you know, huge. I mean, like that's something that like we like a certainly know affects fireflies, and like also lots of other animals, like, you know, sea turtles and things like that. But then on top of that, I think to try and reduce chemical use on your yard. It is like really, really interesting that you find more fireflies in, you know, parts of town where there seem to be many fewer chemicals applied onto lawns. And that's probably because fireflies are all predators, right? And they're like feeding upon like earthworms, snails, and like a slugs. And so things like soil pesticides and also herbicides, fungicides might be affecting some of their prey.
How can it not? I mean, that's one of those. I mean, let's put all sort of poison into the environment and pretend it, you know, I don't need a study that tells me that. You know, you do because you're a scientist. I'll just use common sense and say the more poison we apply, more herbicide, the more pesticide, the more fungicide, the more insecticide we put into the environment, the more damage that's going to do to the full range of species, from birds to slugs to snails to fireflies to earthworms to butter. You know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, if anyone listening, get
absolutely. I can also tell you, I was like studying fireflies up in central Ohio, and I got all these reports about incredible numbers of fireflies over these like Amish farm fields, right? And so I like checked it out, and like it was pretty spectacular. And so we were like wondering what is going on here. And so I like had a permission to like work on this one Amish farm and try to figure out what was special about that area. And I put some of the soil under a microscope, and I was looking at it. And I got to tell you guys, it was like looking down on like Times Square on a Saturday night. I mean, there were like things in there driving little cars around and like everything. It was incredible. And I asked the farmer, what is special about your soil? Because it's so rich in its organic matter. And there's like, there's this incredible ecosystem there. And he said, well, we've had this farm in our family for like many, many generations. And I can tell you, we have never applied any fungicides, any pesticides, any herbicides. We just do crop rotation.
Yeah.
And wow. And it and that like really, really struck me in a huge way, because I could see it. I mean, like under the microscope, it was a vibrant little community which was in balance.
Yeah, the soil biome, which is sort of what you're talking about, has been so degraded across America. You talk about those big fields in Iowa and Ohio, and I'm from Wisconsin, and all of that tilling, all of the industrial application of these poisons to improve yield. Soil in America is toxic and absolute trash compared with it was 100 years ago. That's why our food is also trash, because the soil that it grows in is garbage. And yes, as you know, when we think about conservation, Craig, you and I always talk about this, we think about charismatic megafauna, you know, the manatee, the panther. It all starts in that soil biome. It all starts with those things that you were looking at under a microscope. And I'm sure it would look like the difference between, you know, the deepest section of the Amazon jungle versus Brickell Avenue in Miami, when you talk about biodiversity and that biome you were looking at from the Amish farm versus a big ag soybean field in Nebraska or something.
Has climate change affected fireflies?
That's a good question. And we are not really sure. I mean, like there's like a certainly quite a serious changes in our climate right now. But like it is like hard to address that without like having a lot of data over time. But I think like right now, obviously habitat destruction, having a lot of these like areas essentially drained. I mean like large parts of Florida had like a lot of water in them, and there's a lot of palmettos and things. And like those have been drained to like make them much more suitable for a development. And pretty commonly that whole entire top level of you know, topsoil is just like a scraped off. And then what can the fireflies eat? And then like that, on top of like having all this like a human generated light pumped out into the environment, it's incredible. There are some like a photo series online of the like US at night that like have been taken from a space, and like it is just remarkable how much more light that there like is from our cities. Mm-hmm. And our towns over the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think frankly people are just afraid of the dark, or they feel safer if there's a light on, right? Yeah. And that's affecting lots of these organisms, and it's not just fireflies and you know sea turtles. It's a whole
bird migration. Yeah, man, bird migration. There are every major city in the country, especially on the East Coast, there are the migration monitors that go out in the morning before anyone wakes up, and they're scraping, you know, warblers and all other kinds of migrating birds up dead from window collisions every morning during migration, because the window lights disorient them. Walk around a city, Jacksonville has this not far from where I live. The Duval Audubon goes out and they're pulling up dozens of dead birds every single morning that have struck windows that are lighted from skyscrapers.
Do you encounter kids seeing them for the first time? It just strikes me as a very magical thing for kids to see, you know, they're out in the dark and see this insect that lights up and then
absolutely, Craig. So I think being a kid outside in the summer in the like United States, I think having an interaction with, you know, fireflies is as American as apple pie. I mean, like I think we all when we see that bioluminescence for the first time, it's just, I mean, it's incredible. It's this magical thing, right? And it's like a sense of wonder of like, how does this insect do that? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about studying fireflies is that like fireflies is a great system for trying to like learn about lots of different biological processes and then the insect's behavior and things like that. But then also I think fireflies are a great system with which to like educate the public in like of what is going on outside, just how like complex that is and like what is happening in their own backyard. And I think people tend to protect what they value, and they and the things that they value are the things which they have experience with. And so I think it's really important. Kids ought to be outside, and they should be like picking up rocks and sticks, and they should be like looking at you know fireflies, because like that's the connection that they need with the outside world, with you know nature. And like if when we don't have that, then we're going to have a lot bigger problems.
Yeah, Mark Branham has been our guest. Craig, you like this one. Thank you for the enlightening conversation.
Thank you very much.
Pair this with our lighthouse discussion.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
It's been a pleasure, gentlemen.
Thanks very much. Where did you first see fireflies?
Well, growing up in Wisconsin, like he talked about, and he's kind of a Midwest guy, Kansas, Ohio is where he went to college, everywhere. You know, the soccer fields, my backyard, all around, you know, the neighborhood where they were a part of every single summer night. You know, it was only when I met my wife, who grew up in suburban Atlanta, that I realized that this was not a totally common, regular experience. I'd be asking me when I first saw fireflies and remember them is like asking, when did you first see birds? I mean, they were just always around everywhere. Yeah. You know, I did not realize it was not a totally common experience until I met my wife and my, you know, 30s.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was my, the forest behind my grandmother's house. Mm-hmm. As the dusk would come down, I used to love walking in the woods there. And as the dusk would start to come down, you'd start to see these fireflies sparking up. And, it was just a very magical experience. And, I'm happy to say when my kids were in Boy Scouts, we would go camping in various state parks, and that's where they got to see the fireflies lighting up the night. So
welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.